válido de lunes a jueves. You
the Safari Park. You're killing me, Larry.
Larry, fucking Larry.
Larry from That Larry Show.
For men with balls.
Take off your pants.
Larry, get into bed now.
Larry.
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 It's nearly Christmas. Do people still know what that means? The guy whose name forms the root of the word has been gone for 2,000 years. And his true essence, who he really was, has been so twisted and distorted, more so than any figure in history. Over the centuries, they made him into something he never was. A sad-eyed, sunken-chested, whispering weakling, when in fact, he was the exact opposite. He was a robust charm bomb with more charisma and personal magnetism than anyone who ever lived. If you liked a good party, right? When the wine ran out, he turned gallons of water into the sweetest vintage ever tasted. He could brawl if necessary, too, when he found the temple infested with pimps, thieves, hookers, and loan sharks. Well, he made a weapon, a whip, himself. Marched inside and kicked ass. Do you think that vermin ran without a fight? Of course not. Without a doubt, there were broken teeth, flattened noses, and dislocated jaws. He was a one-man gang. And so the day celebrating his birth has also been so buried in commercial crap, it's now pretty much unrecognizable. Aside from the spiritual element, the birth of JC is a story for the ages because, if nothing else, it shows how, after more than 20 centuries, nothing has changed. Governments are evil and politicians are vermin. They were in his day and they still are to this day. Stop any Christmas shopper at the mall and ask them, what were Joseph and Mary doing in Bethlehem? Would they know that they were neither sightseeing nor vacationing? That they had traveled 70 miles from their home on foot, guided by a huge star, often depicted with a bluish tint? Why was a woman about to give birth on such an arduous journey? Well, because government commanded them to be there. They were mandated to register for the census. Why? Well, so they could pay taxes, of course. Does this sound familiar? And when they finally arrive at their destination, all the Doubletrees and Best Westerns are full, so they crash in a stable, and there, the baby is born, with that magnificent star above. His birth fulfills some ancient prophecies, threatening the power of King Herod, who immediately puts out a contract on an infant. And just to be sure, he orders all the kids under 2 to be slaughtered. Now, does that sound familiar? A shitbag politician feels challenged and orders his stooges to kill innocents? It's all too familiar. Joseph and Mary take their baby and hide out in Egypt for 3 entire years. Until the heat dies down. There is little history of that period, but in Egypt to this day, there are some 26 locations that are verified as places where the young family hid from Herod's hitmen. Which distills that part of the story to a universal theme. Going home. If you think about life, you can almost split it into 2 basic sections, huh? Leaving home and trying to return home. I had the immense good fortune to have a wonderful home. The structure itself was less than modest. The house was barely 1,000 square feet. But my parents made it warm and cozy. We were never cold or hungry. Sure, home can be a state of mind, but it is comprised of bricks and mortar, or clapboard and shingles. And when we think of home, we think not only of the people that made it home, but the things as well. The sound of a rusty hinge on a screen door on a summer evening. A shovel scraping a new snow from the sidewalk. The creaky floorboards beside your bed. The whump of the gas stove as the pilot light ignites a burner. The tick of an antique clock. In the previous episode, I mentioned the story of a big blue star, and that it was as much a part of my childhood home and Christmas as anything in that house, except it wasn't in our house, that is. The street that I lived on was an anomaly through much of New York City. Instead of monstrous brick apartment buildings, this street was lined with little wooden houses. And ours was the smallest of all. It almost looked like some overgrown dollhouse. And the street was also home to many large trees, mostly maples and Dutch elms, which gave some wonderful shade in hot summers and colorful leaves every autumn. Most remarkable of the odd attributes of this little street, which only spanned one block, was that it was home to two churches. On one corner was a very old Lutheran church, built of stone. It was small but beautiful. Each Christmas season there would be an elaborate nativity on the lawn with near life-size statues of Jesus, Mary, Joseph, a donkey, a goat, a couple of lambs, a cow, three magi in their magnificent robes. Many times I was tempted to hop the fence and hang around inside that stable with the statues. I wish that I had. At the other end of the street, opposite our tiny house, was a Methodist church. It was newer than the Lutheran. It was made of clapboard and plain, nowhere near as ornate as the other one. But it had something the Lutheran church did not have. A steeple with a bell in it. Well, actually, the bell was fake. They'd play a recording of a bell through speakers in the belfry. But at Christmas time, this Methodist church kicked the Lutheran's ass, at least through my child's eyes, because just after Thanksgiving, they'd hang a big blue star on that steeple that glowed through the night, throwing its mystical azure light right into my tiny bedroom. There was a cast iron radiator in my room just beneath the window. I would sit on my bed with my feet in that toasty radiator and just stare at that star. Ours was a pretty Catholic household. We went to church every Sunday. There was a crucifix on the wall, not just any crucifix. It was something of an heirloom. It was elaborately carved of some exotic wood and had a hidden compartment that held a candle, a vial of holy water, and a card imprinted with the last rites. From a very young age, I was familiar with the Christmas story, and not just the fat man in the red suit, but the baby in the manger, born under a guiding star on a cold desert night. If the Lutheran's tasteful creche was Bethlehem, well, that Methodist blue star was Vegas, and that also appealed to me. That meant Elvis and Sinatra and the Rat Pack. Imagine Christmas with those cats. At that time, my father worked the night shift for the extra pay. Mom was worried sick over him every night, taking the subway home from Manhattan well after midnight. Manhattan was always a dangerous place, and the subways, while hellish during rush hour, well, they were really risky once the crowds thinned out. There were constant muggings and stabbings. One Christmas Eve, Dad was working. He left the house around dusk in his big wool overcoat. The sky was heavy with snow. There's a weird color clouds used to turn that signaled snow was imminent, kind of a faint yellow tone. When you'd see that color, snow was guaranteed. Of course, my brother and I were ecstatic, a white Christmas. Mom kissed Dad at the front door as a cold blast of air whooshed inside. We all stepped onto the tiny porch and watched him trudge into the night. Her face was etched with worry. We'd already had an early dinner with Dad, Then she made hot chocolate for us. We watched A Christmas Carol on TV. Then it was bedtime because, as every kid knew, if you were not asleep when Santa Claus came around, he would skip your house. This home had three tiny bedrooms. She tucked me in my bed and my brother in his, and I gazed out the window at the blue star. It was beautiful. In my mind's eye, I saw the sleigh and reindeer streak past it, but I also envisioned Joseph and Mary following the original one to Bethlehem. When I lay back, the ceiling in my room was bathed in that wonderful pale blue light. I was awakened sometime later by Mom and my brother. She told us it had snowed and to look outside. Well, we were thrilled, but also wondering why she would awaken us in the middle of the night. We all sat on my bed and looked down the street, now coated in several inches of white powder. No car had yet disturbed it with its tracks. The snow in front of the church had a bluish tint from that electric star. Mom had a beautiful voice and began singing Christmas carols, Silent Night, Little Town of Bethlehem. She had her arms around my brother and me. Then she stopped singing, like there was a catch in her throat. She told us that Dad was very, very late coming home. For a long time, we sat in silence. Her head was pretty much locked to the left, which was the direction he'd be coming from. In my five-year-old mind, I figured my dad had maybe lost his way in the snow and would find it if he looked for that blue electric star high on the church steeple. Mom suddenly gasped and stood, and there, way down the street, was my old man, hands in his pockets, his collar up and a scarf around his neck, striding through that snow at a brisk pace. She wiped tears from her face as she hugged us tightly, and then told us to get back to bed, or Santa wouldn't come. In the morning, the previous night was forgotten, and it was all about tearing the wrapping off the gift boxes. Years later, I asked her what had kept Dad that Christmas Eve, and it was some Subway mayhem, of course. Fast forward a few decades, and I found myself in Los Angeles with a wife and a five-year-old daughter and another 10 months old. It was a Saturday in December, low 70s, and not a hint of snow. And that Christmas, as every Christmas, I thought about that blue star and seeing my dad in its heavenly light coming home to us. So I decided to make a big blue star for my house. Got the wood and the bolts and nuts and miter saw and about 100 C9 LEDs and another 100 zip ties. And my little girls sat with me, and together we built it. They handed me pliers and sockets and electrical tape and zip ties, and after a few hours, we had an all-original, one-of-a-kind Christmas star. When it was done, I etched our names and December 2006 in the back of it. For many years, that star lit up the chimney outside our house. We loved it. Sometimes people would ask where we bought it, and they were always disappointed to discover it could not be bought. After about 14 or 15 years, a few of the bulbs went dark. They were fused to the base and couldn't be replaced. Others didn't burn as brightly as when new. That star was one of the few items that came with us when we moved east. A couple of weeks ago, I fished it out of the garage, brushed off the dust, and plugged it in. Only 5 bulbs lit up. I stripped off all the old wires and bulbs and zip ties and bought 100 C7 LED blue bulbs, reputedly the best money could buy, and they were not cheap, but this star would be worth the expense. It took me a lot of hours to make the new one. The bulbs are sold separately, even they had to be screwed in once all the wires were in place, Precisely 2.5 inches apart was how I rigged it. I was more careful about building this star than the first. In the original, some of the bulbs were not quite perpendicular to the frame, which gave it a bit of a sloppy look. This one was crafted with precision. It looks machine-made and throws some serious lumens. It can probably be seen from passing aircraft. It flies in the face of the Martha Stewart New England aesthetic of everything low-key and understated. Yeah, its wattage definitely says, Vegas, baby. Some neighbors probably think it's gauche and gaudy. Good. It's there to celebrate the greatest event in the history of mankind. Why be subtle about that? If you're curious and want to see the original version and the new star, I'll post pictures of both on the homepage at thatlarryshow.com. Not too long after I built that first star, my then very young kids and my brother and I went back to the old neighborhood in Queens. It was a warm summer afternoon. The Lutheran church, made of stone, was still there on the far corner, but the Methodist church, home of the Blue Star, had vanished, replaced by dreary brick apartment buildings. Our little house still stood. The original green shingles remained, but looked pretty tired. Whoever lived there now didn't care much about its appearance. Where once was a tiny lawn, green and lush, and rimmed by flowers, was just a pile of dirt. The remaining houses all had an accessory they did not have when we lived there. Iron bars. Every window was barred. Every door was mesh steel and bars. Like a pox on the skin of a diseased person, bars, especially bars on homes, indicate a neighborhood, a town, a city, a society, is very, very sick. I wonder if someday my kids will go back to Los Angeles and visit their childhood homes, and what they'll find when they do. We fled because what was once a suburban haven had turned into a hellscape. A hellscape engineered by corrupt leftist politicians. A big part of the original Christmas story is the search for home, even a temporary one. Thomas Wolfe said, "You can't go home again." Not entirely true. Sometimes you can, but you may not like what you find. So we look ahead to a better place and make a brighter, bluer star. Wherever you are this Christmas, whether surrounded by people who love you or solamente searching for home, take comfort in the knowledge that you really are not alone. The hunt for home is an ongoing part of the human experience. It was 2,000 years ago for a baby who spent his first 3 years on the road, running for his life. And what a brief but extraordinary life it was, a life well summarized by a newspaper man a century ago. This story has been a tradition on this show now for 7 years. He was born in an obscure village, the child of a peasant woman. He grew up in another village. He worked in a carpenter shop until he was 30. Then for 3 years, he was an itinerant preacher. He never owned a home. He never wrote a book. He never held an office. He never had a family. He never went to college. He never put his foot inside a big city. He never traveled 200 miles from the place he was born. He never did any of the things that usually accompany greatness. He had no credentials but himself. While still a young man, the tide of popular opinion turned against him. His friends ran away. He was turned over to his enemies. He went through the mockery of a trial. He was nailed upon a cross between two thieves. While he was dying, his executioners gambled for the only piece of property he had on Earth, his coat. When he was dead, he was laid in a borrowed grave. 2,000 years have come and gone, and today he remains the central figure for much of the human race. All the armies that ever marched, all the navies that ever sailed, all the parliaments that ever sat, and all the kings that ever reigned, put together, have not affected the life of man upon this earth as powerfully as has that one solitary life. Thank you for listening and being with me. God bless you, and have a Merry Christmas.